Hello and welcome to the Inspireland podcast, where we make what's relevant interesting. This episode's guest is Maggie McNeil, author of one of the world's most reputable sex work blogs. In the show, Maggie tells us about her upbringing as a Catholic middle-class girl and her journey into what she calls whoredom. She also discusses being the only call girl in New Orleans post-Katrina in 2005 and a very unpleasant experience she had at the hands of the New Orleans Police Department. Maggie is charming, intelligent and engaging, and is making it her mission to inform the world that she was not unique as a call girl of these qualities. She isn't a broken doll, as sex workers are so often portrayed in the mainstream media. She is a great interview. Enjoy. So I'm joined on the phone by Maggie McNeil. Maggie has been a librarian, a housewife, a call girl and a madam. She is the author of the Honest Courtesan blog on WordPress, has been published in the Washington Post, also has a book of short stories called Ladies of the Night, and has a fantastic accent. You're very welcome to Inspireland, Maggie.
Thank you, Dave. It's funny because one never thinks that one has an accent. You know,
yeah.
Until one speaks, one always hears other people's accents, but not one's own.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's just the first time we spoke on the phone, kind of after we discussed over Twitter and by email. It was just a pleasure to hear that southern accent, and it's one that we're so familiar with in Ireland from, you know, from US TV. I've also been watching True Detective, so I'm quite kind of in tune with it at the minute. But listen, it's great to have you on the show, and thanks a million for agreeing to speak to us.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Great. So listen, I'm going to get stuck in immediately. What is the purpose of the Honest Courtesan blog? What do you hope to achieve?
The main thing I'm trying to achieve is there's this persistent idea, this persistent notion that sex workers are somehow different from other people, other women specifically, that, you know, it's not so much a thing, even though there are male sex workers, the rhetoric doesn't seem to be directed to them so much. It seems to be more of an issue with women. The idea that female sex workers are somehow different from other women, that we're either damaged or victims, or of course formerly that we were seductresses or scarlet women, bad women, Jezebels,
yeah.
This sort of thing. And the purpose of the blog is basically just to show that that's not true, just to show that we are like anybody else, that there's the only one thing, if there's one single thing that separates sex workers from other women, is that we tend to be enough more comfortable with sex that we can use it as a job.
Okay.
And that's really a very small difference.
Absolutely.
that's not that much of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things, kind of, because when I began researching the subject, having spoken to yourself, I immediately lost the mystique that I would have previously had about sex work and how it's portrayed in the media. And very quickly, I kind of became normalized, I suppose, to the type of the language kind of used around sex work. And even like in kind of conversations with friends and colleagues, you know, just about the topic, exactly what you've spoken about came up. They all seem to return to the idea of the damaged woman, okay?
Yeah,
and the idea,
absolutely.
Of, you know, of what you speak about yourself, you call it the broken doll theory. Your experience is obviously quite different. You don't see sex workers as damaged in some way. What qualifies you to make that assertion?
That's a good question. I mean, I've met and spoken to an awful lot of sex workers. I've read a tremendous number of studies, and the evidence simply isn't there. They're not anecdotally, not in personal experience, and not in the studies I've read. There's just not any evidence. I mean, certainly there are some sex workers who are broken dolls, but there are some teachers who are broken dolls, and there are some insurance agents who are broken dolls, and you know, there are some doctors who are broken dolls, and so on and so forth. I don't think we have a larger percentage than any other profession.
Okay.
I just haven't seen it. That having been said, I think that a person who has one of the things that's been said by sex workers I've read on the internet who do have mental health issues, that the work can be a godsend for them because they don't have to maintain other people's schedules. They don't have to be concerned with, well, if they have a bad day, that they have to go to work anyway. They can just take a day off.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I think you're right. I do think it comes down to the issue of sex. Like, when you take everything away and kind of when I question people about it, you know, about what their issue was, it always settled back at that point. It's the sex. That's what it is.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And then you think to yourself, okay, so why is sex so different? And pretty much everybody I asked, including a colleague of mine about half an hour ago, when I was discussing speaking to you, had no answer to that question. You know?
No, they don't.
So I'm going to throw at you just a few things at the start, right out the gate, that people say about kind of sex work that I know you have feelings on from kind of having read what you've written, and just let you give me a few answers. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So, exchanging money for sex is degrading. Respond.
Well, so what part of it is degrading? Is it the exchanging money? Because if it's the exchanging money, then you're making a Marxist argument, and that's a different discussion.
Yeah.
If it's the sex itself, then, well, you know, perhaps you might want to find a different way for human beings to reproduce, because it's not going to change anytime soon. So when you take two things that are not degrading, and you marry them together, how does the result somehow become degrading? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the observation the American comedian George Carlin put
I
it.
I love him.
He put
great
it very
guy.
Vulgarly, but he said, you know, selling is legal, and sex is legal. So why isn't selling sex legal?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can you answer that question? Why do you think that people have such an issue with it?
I think it goes down to the old Madonna whore thing.
Okay.
The idea that there's two kinds of women, good women and bad women, and good women are the women who behave themselves and who act in a way accordance with social rules, and that those are good women and those are worthy of rights and those are worthy of respect and et cetera. And then there are bad women, the ones who refuse to conform, and those women are not worthy of respect.
Okay.
Or rights. And what the social norms are have changed some over the years.
Okay.
But the Madonna whore is still there, and a lot of people who label themselves feminists are just as stuck in this Madonna whore as the so-called patriarchs that they're always, you know, talking about.
Okay.
Because they've still set up two kinds of women. They've set up the kinds of women who believe in these feminist principles, and they've set up the other kind of women who does not. And sex workers are part of that group that does not, and therefore, again, in these women's minds, we're not worthy of respect. We're just creatures to be saved, to be rescued, to be, you know, protected from our own selves.
Yeah.
And this is you know, they don't see that it's the same old thing over again.
Yeah, it's funny.
Well,
like,
refuse to see.
Yeah, I've done some work on the treatment of female offenders in the penal system in Ireland and abroad, but mainly Ireland. And there are two kind of broad strands of perception about how women are treated by a male-dominated justice system. The first is that they're treated with chivalry, that they're kind of treated overly fairly, if you like, with positive discrimination, because they're only women subjected to kind of emotions in a way that men aren't. The second is that they're kind of not just that they're in danger of a life of crime or something outside the social norms criminally, but also that their morality is something that's more to be worried about than with young male offenders, say. And both of the standpoints are kind of offensive to women, I find, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, it's just an interesting kind of a thing. The second thing I wanted to cover just on this is the idea that prostitution is a dangerous profession. In your experience, would it be more dangerous than other professions?
It is. And there's two reasons for that. One of the reasons is intrinsic, and the other is extrinsic.
Okay.
The intrinsic reason is that when you deal with members of the public, you're going to be in more danger than when you just deal with objects, you know, that are behaving themselves. In other words, if you have to go out and go to people's houses and, you know, be in places where people might behave unpredictably, that job, whatever it is, whether it be policeman, whether it be teacher, whether it be social worker, is going to be more dangerous than a job where you sit behind a desk and the most dangerous thing you have to deal with is a computer.
Okay.
Because human beings are not predictable.
Absolutely.
So you know, so yes, it's intrinsically more dangerous in that way, but many, many, many other professions share that with it.
Okay.
The extrinsic reason is criminalization. The more you criminalize a profession, the more dangerous it gets.
Why? Why is that, Maggie?
Well, the number one source, and people don't want to believe this, but it's absolutely true. Again, it's true anecdotally, and it's also true, and studies have shown, you know, when large numbers of sex workers are surveyed, the number one danger in sex work in every country where it's even somewhat criminalized, whether it's partially criminalized like it is in Ireland, or whether it's fully criminalized like it is in the United States, the number one danger is always the police.
Okay.
It's always the police. There is a...
is that police in terms of exploitation of the sex workers, or what do you mean by police?
In every way.
Okay.
In every way. There was a big outcry in the United States last week because in Hawaii, the police officials were trying to get the legislature to maintain a provision in Hawaiian law that police were allowed to have sex with sex workers before arresting them.
Oh my God! For sting type operations.
For police to trick them
okay.
into having sex in order to arrest them. Now, there was a big huge outcry about this, and I wrote a column where I pointed out that the only thing unusual under Hope was that they were trying to enshrine it in law.
Yeah.
That is standard practice in every part of the United States.
Okay.
In every part of the United States, cops, and not all cops, you know, in some departments, the police chiefs personally don't allow this. But it's not because it's not the practice, it's not because the law says they can't, it's merely because the individual police chief does not like it.
Okay.
But this happens all the time, that cops will have sexual contact to one level or another, you know, manual or oral or full-out vaginal contact, you know, before arresting them.
Okay.
And this is. I mean, you basically are saying that it's okay for police to rape them.
And that's what I mean. So you're speaking about danger and kind of one of the main threats being the police.
So that's one.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
One way.
All right.
But then there's also the fact of I mean, that's a more direct thing, but just the very fact that an arrest in and of itself is violent. An arrest is violent. When you have a armed men threatening women with guns and manhandling them and twisting their arms behind their back and putting chains on them and dragging them and throwing them in cages, this is violent.
Yeah.
This is extremely violent. And that kind of just violence, In a civilized society, we might justify that kind of violence against a violent person.
Okay.
In other words, we say if this person is a murderer, this person is a rapist, this person is a robber.
Absolutely.
That kind of violence could be justified against that sort of person.
Yeah.
But we're talking here about allowing the police to inflict violence against women for consensual sex.
Okay. So your argument is, I suppose, that just the one you've made, is that for non-violent crime, violence should not be used in the arrests
Correct.
Procedure, in the legal
Correct.
Procedure at all.
Correct.
Okay,
Correct.
Absolutely.
It shouldn't even be there.
Yeah.
And yet it is.
Yeah.
And so there's that, and then there's police extorting extorting sex workers for money or for sex.
And how widespread would that be, Maggie? Would that be kind of pretty widespread in your experience, yes?
Very much so. There was a study of street sex workers in Chicago that found that a measurable fraction, I don't remember what the exact fraction, but it was like 10%
okay.
of their work was actually giving freebies to cops in order to not get arrested.
And that was the exchange, not to be arrested and prosecuted. There was no financial
Correct.
Benefit to the girls.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But it's still, you're still talking about extortion. You're still talking about, in some countries, of course, robbery is a lot more common. In India and in South Africa, particularly ones I've read, it's very common for the police to literally rob sex workers.
Okay.
To just shake them down, give me all your money or I will arrest you. And so that's the number one danger is always with the police.
That's
incredible.
And then
you go down from there. you have things where when you push anything, any behavior into the shadows, you're going to attract more criminal elements. When you have to transact your business in private, you can't go to the police if something does happen. You know, if you own a grocery store and someone comes in and robs you, well, you can go to the police, can't you? You can say, you know, okay, someone robbed me. The other day, a sex worker was robbed, and very foolishly. I mean, she was young, and I guess she just wasn't thinking.
Okay.
This was in Connecticut, I believe. She went to the police to report a robbery. And, of course, when they found out she was a sex worker, they arrested her instead.
Jesus, okay.
So we can't go to the police, and that, of course, and people know that. There was an example in England very recently where men came in and robbed a sex worker because they assumed she would not go to the police. And so that assumption attracts crime.
Okay.
So, again, it's not intrinsic to the profession. It's intrinsic to the criminalization.
Okay.
Because you've basically defined this group of women as a group of women that are not worthy of the protection of the law. And obviously that's going to attract certain elements, you know, to a greater degree than those elements will be attracted to other people, because whom they fear might be protected.
Okay. Did you ever come across any police who went the other way, Maggie, who were kind of protective or kind of instilled in their police forces an attitude of looking after these safer streetwalkers, more vulnerable members of society?
Not in the United States.
Really?
I'm sure that there may be some individuals. And in the United States, we certainly had clients who were. I mean, I saw several cops, you know, during the time that I was in sex work, but they never told you up front. You didn't find out until later.
Okay.
That they were. They would let something slip, or you know, or whatever. And they might, as individual people, say, "I think the laws are stupid, and I think this shouldn't be illegal." You know, but that's in their personal life. That's not in their role.
Yeah.
As a cop.
So as soon as the
cop,
yeah, the uniform's on, they're back in that role.
Correct.
Okay.
And in the United States, any sex worker is a criminal. It's flat out. It's very different. This is something that I think people, and because of American television and American movies, it's very strange, because even people in countries like Ireland, where sex work itself is not criminalized, sometimes people have the impression from American television and from American movies that it is.
Okay.
Because it is here. You see what I'm saying? And so
yeah.
You'll hear people say, but sex, you know, it's against the law. No, it's not against the law there, actually. There are a lot of activities around it, brothel keeping and pimping and things like that, you know, that are illegal. But the actual exchange of money for sex is not illegal in Ireland.
Okay.
It is in the United States.
Yeah. And that's
even
universal. That's federal in the United States, is it?
No, it's not federal.
Okay.
There are federal laws against prostitution in certain ways, but they're pretty specific. Like, there's the Mann Act, which basically says you can't cross a state line. So, in other words, if I had an escort service in New Orleans, we would sometimes get calls from a small city in Mississippi. So it was across the Louisiana state line, you see.
Okay.
And I would get a call from somebody who had access to the New Orleans phone book, and I would not ever send girls there. Because sending a girl there, crossing a state line, would change it from a misdemeanor to a felony.
Okay. And what would the punishment be if you were found guilty of that?
It varies, but it can be decades.
Decades? That's incredible.
Yes.
That's incredible. And sorry, you mentioned New Orleans, right? Which kind of brings me to the next thing I'd like to discuss. You were there for Katrina in 2005, right?
Yeah.
When did you first know that something was wrong? Because I know you kind of described having had experiences of severe weather up to that. When did you know that Katrina was different?
It's funny. It's a good story, actually. All my life, I've never been afraid of hurricanes because I was raised with them. You
okay.
know, this is normal for me. And so, what what happened with Katrina, we, you know, we were just going to weather it out like every other storm. You know, it wasn't going to be anything different for us. It wasn't going to be any strange, you know, nothing different, nothing out of the ordinary. And what happened was on Sunday morning, and I don't remember, I think Katrina hit, most of the people started evacuating on Saturday, Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
But the but Sunday morning, I woke up very, very, very early. I had trouble sleeping all night long. I was very fitful. I was in a kind of a bad mood. I didn't know why. It was just like a feeling. And I woke up extremely early Sunday morning, and my cat was running around the bedroom, literally running like up the walls, which she had never done before.
Okay.
She was just running around, just, and of course we know the story about, you know, how animals will act strangely.
Yeah, they can sense the change in air pressure and stuff.
They can sense the change.
Yeah.
And I woke my husband up and I said, "We need to go." And he's like, "What?" And I said, "This is different." I used those words. I said, "This is different. This is not right." I said, "We need to get out of here." I said, "Look at what our cat is doing, you know." And he looked and he's like, "Yeah, you're right, you know." And he trusts my feelings. He doesn't know where they come from necessarily. But he says, "No, I'm going to trust your instinct." And of course, I had to logically rationalize it to myself too, because I try to be a rational person.
Yeah, you sound more science based than feeling based. I'm surprised to hear this.
I am.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, I said, "Okay, look." I said this to him. I said, "What happens if we stay? If we stay, the power is going to go out no matter what. We're not going to have any business. You know, you're not going to be going into your work. I doubt I'll have anything with my work. We have our country place. Let's just go up there.
Okay.
Let's just make it a week of vacation, you know, and then we'll come back next week and everything will be fine." So I rationalized it. And so we got everything together into the car. We didn't really have a lot of valuable things there anyway.
Okay.
Because everything was up in the country. And so we packed up the car and left. And fortunately for us, I know every back street in New Orleans and every back road in South Louisiana.
One of the benefits of a misspent life, Maggie.
Exactly. And so we were able to get out. We were able to get out of New Orleans while the main highways were literally just like parking lots. I mean, the traffic was not even moving.
Okay.
Just people lined up in gigantic, you know, many miles long lines. We were able to bypass that. There were a few bottlenecks, and that we got caught in. You know, we'd be caught in this bottleneck, like where we had to cross the Mississippi River.
Okay.
The number of bridges is very limited, so we were stuck in a line doing that. But once we were on the other side, we were able to, you know, open up and move quickly again.
And sorry, just to interject there for a second, what was the atmosphere like? So we've all seen this scene in movies. Like, bear in mind, the closest to a natural disaster we get in Ireland is like 5 days of repeated sunshine. So, you know, what is the atmosphere like in traffic in a situation like that? The hurricane hadn't hit yet, right? You just knew it was coming. What does it feel like?
Well, I personally, I'm probably not the one to ask, because I have a sort of a phobia about being trapped in some place I can't get out of.
Okay.
And that includes traffic. It's not claustrophobia, because I have no problem being in a tight space if I can move. The problem is being in a space where I cannot get out. So, like, even in traffic, even in broad daylight where you can see all around you, it's the fact of being unable to get out of that traffic.
Yeah.
That I have a phobic reaction to. So my reaction to being caught in traffic is probably much stronger than other people's reaction. So I'm really not a good person to ask. I wouldn't be a good... my reaction's too strong.
Okay. So
I get extremely frustrated.
Yeah,
Even trapped for an hour in traffic, I'm at a level of, you know, barely can stand it.
Okay. So you left then, and how long were you gone? You left and you watched the news, right? You saw what went on.
Yeah.
You got away safely, thank God. You came back. How soon did you return to New Orleans and why?
I don't remember exactly. I want to say 2 weeks. It might have been three. It was late September when we came back. I do remember that. And what happened was, you know, we were staying away, and my operator, I have it at an old lady that I used to forward the phones to. She used to take the night shift.
Okay.
The day shift, the early morning and day shift. I would take the night shift.
All right.
And anyway, she had the phones. You know, we hadn't transferred them away from her. And she called me up on my personal phone and said, Maggie, you need to come back to New Orleans. The phone is ringing off the hook. And I'm like, are you kidding? And she's like, no. She said, I'm having to tell people, you know, 30, 40 times a day that we don't have anybody.
All right.
And I said, really? And so I talked to my husband, and his company actually wanted him to go back to do some things in the office there. And so he said, well, let's go. Let's do it, you know. And so one thing, one advantage I had is that because of his work, because his work was with a company that was big enough to get political connections if they needed them, you know.
Always.
They were able to get passes for us and things like that. So we were able to, you know, go against the curfew and all. But it still was kind of a pain at first of having to deal with checkpoints every time I went out to do a call.
Yeah. So describe the city on your return. Like, you say checkpoints, curfew. What was it like? Did you recognize the city you returned to?
No. I mean, yes and no. I mean, physically. But it was just such a strange, strange environment. Just the debris everywhere, and the smell, and the abandonedness of it. You know, there's practically just nobody. And most of the people that were there were not locals. You know, most of them were people that were, you know, disaster workers.
Yeah.
Nearly all male. Very, very few female faces. When I used to go to pick up, they were giving out like ration packs to people because most of the stores were closed, you know, so the disaster relief people were given, and you could go every morning and get these disaster ration packs. Well, I would go every morning, and when I would get there, they would always give me extra.
Why, Maggie,
and they were always more than happy to carry it to my car for me.
Okay.
And it's always, do you need anything else? Can I bring it? You know, because, of course, they hadn't seen a pretty face in so long. So.
Yeah, yeah. And you carried a gun at that stage. I read in your blog that because the city was, like, predominantly male, you felt the need to carry a gun. Like, that's a very alien concept. Do you know how to shoot a gun?
Oh, very much so.
Okay, all right.
Very much so. I was raised in the country, I've had several boyfriends and my ex-husband and my present husband that have all made sure that they all had to make sure to their satisfaction that I knew how to use a gun. So every time I start a new relationship, there's always this phase where, well, I have to make sure you know how to shoot. I go, okay.
That's crazy.
And then they're always surprised when I get above 0.8 on the range, you know.
Okay, okay. And is that like a kind of a first anniversary present you'd be getting in the States, a nice gun?
Not in most parts of the States.
Okay.
I'm from a rural area, it's a little different in the country.
Yeah.
When we first moved out to our place here, this had not been. We found ruins actually of an old house here, which is probably about 100 years old, but there hadn't been anybody living in this area since electrification.
Oh my God!
There had never been. There had never been power lines to this particular property. There was no water to this property. We had to do all that. And so when we first got here, there were a lot of wild animals. There still are a lot of wild animals, but there was a cougar, a mountain lion.
No way.
That this was her territory. I know she was a she because we saw her with a cub once, but she... she would come and go, and we'd see her paw prints, and we'd see her feces and things like that, you know. So, I mean, she was around. So when we first got here for the first year, my husband insisted that I carry the gun whenever I leave the house. And she never approached us, you know, with, and as the months went by, we saw her less and less.
All right.
She was smart enough, you know, to stay away from humans, but we couldn't be sure of that.
Yeah, I'd say two alpha females in the one area like that can't be good, Maggie. Somebody,
no.
Somebody has to win. So to return to New Orleans, you went back to work. You were very busy. What type of work were you doing and with whom? You said most people who were there were from outside because the residents had left.
Well, it's interesting. It was different in the sense that agency escort work is a little bit different from independent escort work in the sense that you you really get a bunch of different things. You get some guys who are just looking for pretty much the straight sex, nothing else.
Okay.
You get the guys who want the whole experience of taking the girl out and bringing her to dinner and all that sort of thing. And you've got the guys who just want to talk. You've got the guys who have some sort of fantasy they want help with, all those different things.
Okay.
Well, after Katrina, I found that a lot of the people that I saw were not really interested in sex per se. I mean, some of them wanted it. It was there. But it wasn't the main reason they called, and it wasn't what we spent most of our time doing.
Okay.
Sometimes, some of them didn't even want sex at all. Some of them just wanted to talk. Some of them just wanted, one guy I will never forget. When I got undressed and I was with him and I was going to start, you know, doing things with him. And
yeah.
He said, no. He said, I don't want to do any of that. And I gave him a quizzical look and he said, no, I'm married and I want to be faithful to my wife. He said, but it's just that he was one of the workers that dealt with the cleanup.
Okay.
And he said, I just see so much ugliness all day long. I just want to see something beautiful for a while.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And that's all he wanted. He just wanted to be held and talked to and just that human contact. That's all he wanted.
Okay. That's a beautiful story,
yeah. And
there
was a lot of guys that were like that.
That's beautiful, yeah. Maggie, you spoke on your blog about when you got the call to the hotel, the Royal Sonesta. Would you tell us what happened in that situation, please?
Sure. Oh, well, what happened was, as I was saying, that you know you have to consider that how the police were saying that they were very understaffed, and there was all this huge area of the city that was essentially abandoned. So they were stressed about having to patrol all this. And they were understaffed, and there was still a good bit of crime going on, the sort of thing that happens when the social order collapses.
Of course.
And yet, in all this, they still thought it was worth devoting 15 cops for several hours to bust one escort, which gives you an idea of the sort of prioritization that happens in the United States.
You did have a gun, though, Maggie. You did have a gun.
Oh, but not on me.
Okay. Okay, so what happened? What was your experience? You got this call, you went to the hotel.
I went to the hotel, and the guy, we literally started talking about the weather.
Okay.
And because he said he was from out of town, and he may have been. He didn't have a New Orleans accent, certainly. And I asked him if he wanted a back rub, and he said sure, and I started giving him a back rub. And when you've rubbed a lot of people's backs, you begin to notice that men in different professions tend to have stresses in their backs, knotted muscles in different places.
Okay.
Like I've noticed that golfers and fishermen, the right shoulder is extremely knotty, whereas, you know, more so than in other professions.
Okay.
But this guy had this very strange muscle knot on his left lower back.
Okay.
And I had never encountered that before. And I was asking about it. I said, why do you have this muscle knot right here? And as it turns out later, once I realized he was a cop, I realized that's probably where his gun rest was wearing in disguise under a coat.
Okay, okay.
And the pressing of the metal against the body, you know, the body tenses up.
Sure. That's just incredible. So you could tell a guy, if I brought a golfer to you, you could tell he was a golfer, right?
A golfer or a fisherman.
That's incredible. Yeah.
One or the other.
You could tell by the smell whether he was a golfer or a fisherman.
No, by the muscle.
That's incredible, yeah.
But, well, one learns with what one does. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But we were there, and I was doing this, rubbing his back, and then suddenly he jumps. There's a knock on the door. And that occasionally happens when you're in a call in a hotel. But what happens is the client always ignores it because it'll be room service or something like that, you know. But this guy jumps up and starts running to the door. I'm like, "Where do you think you're going?" And he's like, "Oh, well, that's my friend. He's bringing me my hat." And I'm like, "No." And I'm going, "No," like that. And then he opens the door, and these guys start filing in. And the first four or five guys to come in all looked very thuggish.
Okay.
And so I was like, "Oh my God!" And I figured, I honestly figured I was going to be gang raped.
Okay.
That's what I thought was going to happen. And then the next one to come in looks like a businessman. And I'm like, "Oh, wait a minute!" And then, of course, as they keep filing in, I realize what it is.
Yeah.
You know. But, and this is the funny part. My reaction is something like that, and lots of boyfriends have said that I'm probably going to get myself killed reacting this way. When I realized that there were cops, I went from being scared to being angry.
Okay.
And so I'm standing here stark naked, right? A 130-pound woman, you know, let's say 9.5 stone.
Okay.
You know, standing there, basically cursing out these cops. Like, "What do you think you're doing?" You know, and all this kind of stuff. And within a couple of minutes, I realized that they were embarrassed. I was embarrassing them because what they expected me to do was to react fearfully and to try to cover myself and things like that. That's what they wanted. That's what they expected. That was the thrill they were going to get. And when I didn't react that way, when I stood there arguing with no trace of being, you know, embarrassed or ashamed, Their whole attitude changed.
It flipped. They got embarrassed.
Yes, because I had changed the script on them.
Okay.
And so finally one of them says, "Put your clothes on," you know. So but then I told him, I said, "Look, you know, if I can get in touch with my lawyer, and this will be all over in 5 minutes, but they have to go through their little, you know, song and dance."
Yeah.
So it was at least another hour, maybe it was 2 hours altogether. And finally, they gave me my phone call. And in those days, I kept a lawyer on retainer.
Okay.
And I called him up, and he called a friend of his who was a judge, and the judge called jail, and the judge told them, "Let her go."
All right.
And they hadn't even finished the booking process.
And what were you charged with, Maggie?
Well, this is the thing, you see, and this is one of the interesting things about the whole incident. The cop in the room told me I was going to be charged with prostitution and crime against nature. Now, crime against nature is a little Louisiana law that goes back to the 1800s, which means oral or anal sex.
Okay.
Now, in the United States, laws like that, sodomy laws, were struck down by the United States Supreme Court in 2003,
okay,
2 years before this incident happened. In a case called Lawrence versus Texas.
All right.
And so what happened was, in Louisiana, somebody had the foresight a few years before to actually, one of the odd things about Louisiana law is that since it's based on Code Napoleon rather than English common law, like the other 49 states, everything has to be spelled out. Under Code Napoleon, every single thing has to have a separate... the Louisiana law books, compared to other states' law books, are like five times as big.
Okay.
There's a huge, huge number of law books. So anyway, somebody had the foresight to create a separate crime called crime against nature by solicitation.
All right.
And this was a felony. And so that was still on the books, because since it involved prostitution... Technically, Lawrence versus Texas had not struck it down. So what was happening is this cop told me that I was going to be charged with this, and this is a felony, and I also knew that when if you were convicted of this, then you would be put on the sex offender registry.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. So a few months later, I mean, after all this is over and I'm released and everything, a few months later, when my lawyer calls me to say, okay, you know, the case is coming up, we need to talk about it, he goes, what do you want? He says, you just want this to go away, right? And I said, right. And he goes, okay, well, we're just gonna take a plea and you'll pay a fine and it'll be done. I said, yeah, but I'm not going to go on the sex offender registry. He goes, what sex offender registry for what? And I said, for the crime against nature. It's a felony. He goes, there's no crime against nature charge here.
Okay.
And I said, what? He says, no, just simple prostitution. It's a misdemeanor. He says, and the judge has already agreed to seal the case. So your record will be expunged. So it'll go away, literally. I'll pay $300 and it'll go away.
Okay.
And I said, that's interesting because the cop told me that I was going to be charged with that. Now, since I started blogging and doing a lot of reading about it, I found out something. I found out that the majority of the people that are that were condemned to the sex offender registry in Louisiana for these bogus crime against nature charges were generally poor.
Yeah.
They were street workers. They were black. Sometimes they were trans people.
Okay.
And so basically what happened was the cop just went with his script. But when it got to the district attorney's office, the district attorney saw a middle-class white prostitute with a lawyer.
Okay.
They dropped it because they didn't want that to go to court.
Yeah.
They didn't want that law challenged. So in other words, when it was poor black women or trans women that they were throwing it at, they'll make that stick because they know that this is a person who hasn't got a lawyer that probably can't defend herself that's going to take the plea. When it was someone that potentially could challenge it and draw attention to it, they made it go away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's really very, you know, I'm saying that it's sad. And maybe it's why the law stood for so long. And what happened was eventually, just a few years ago, a couple of different organizations, a New Orleans organization called Women with a Vision, which works with poor women, they challenged the law, and they had some help from a couple of legal aid type organizations. And eventually that law, the law itself wasn't overturned, but it was changed into a misdemeanor.
Okay, okay.
And so when it was changed into a misdemeanor, that removed the necessity for sex offender registration. But then they actually had to file a separate case because the Louisiana authorities were stubbornly saying that even though it was no longer a registrable offense, that they were going to still keep all the people who had been registered in the past
previously
on the registry.
Yeah. We just have a case going on here in Ireland at the minute that kind of broke recently regarding kind of the tapping of the Garda Ombudsman. So essentially the watchdog for the police force over here, it was discovered that their office was being tapped. And the kind of the allegation or the suggestion would have been that the only people who really would have gained from this tapping was the police force themselves.
So we
had this big Ferrari kind of about it. It was in the media. Unlike a lot of these stories, it stayed beyond 3 days and kind of went on for a month. I find sometimes those stories are big news and disappear. Anyway, then it transpires that the head of the police force, a guy called Callanan, resigns citing family reasons about 8 hours before a story breaks that they've been recording phone calls from certain lines in police stations since the 1980s, right? And the reality of this is that if they can prove that the privilege between a client and a lawyer was breached through the listening and recording of these phone calls, that a lot of serious criminals could find the cases could collapse and they could
of
be
course.
Back on the streets. And all put in place, I would imagine, and like this stuff is already a matter of record that the recordings took place. I can only assume they weren't listening to people ringing their wives, discussing their dinner plans. But if they use this type of stuff, it just means that they hadn't got the ability to police the crimes effectively, and as a result took a shortcut, which is going to look very bad on a police force who in Ireland generally have a very good reputation, far and above what it sounds like, you know, the New Orleans police force had, you know.
No, American police forces are very, very, they've been given too much power.
Yeah.
What happened, and we don't have an ombudsman here. We there are sometimes what they call internal affairs departments, but
sure,
the internal affairs departments are part of the police force.
Yeah, cops investigating cops. That's why they brought the ombudsman in over here, you know.
Yeah, there were a few attempts in different places here to try things like that, and usually they come. What happens is you'll have rampant corruption will hit the news. A citizens group will form and demand some sort of a separate, you know, an independent panel.
Yeah.
The independent panel is created with a great hullabaloo, and then that independent panel soon finds that no recommendations they make have any teeth whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it slowly fades away and goes
Yeah,
away.
It's one of the things we do over here. I mean, politics is pretty much the same the world over, right?
Of course.
But what we find over here is there's a committee set up, there's an investigation, and by the time the investigation reports, people have moved on to the 15-story
yes.
post-investigation,
yes.
And the appetite and the anger, most importantly, is no longer there, you know? I want to kind of jump back for a while, right? Just in terms of your own background. People have already established, you know, you're intelligent, you're well-educated. Hopefully we've disrupted some myths at least already. You were born in New Orleans in 1966. You were middle class, you were white, and you were Catholic. Where did it all go wrong, Maggie? How come, I suppose really what I want to ask is, on a serious note, how come you didn't seem to develop the sexual hang-ups and kind of Catholic guilt that a lot of us would have experienced?
I think what happened was too much of a bad thing. I think what happened was that, honestly, my mother was so hung up that she never discussed sex with me in any way whatsoever.
Okay.
It never came up. I didn't even get the "don't do that" because she didn't even bring it up. When I would have, I was precocious, was a very precocious child, and her stock answer for any sort of sexual question I had was, "Oh, you knew all that already."
Okay.
She assumed that I had already read about it and looked it up and things like that. And even, for example, even when I started menstruating fairly early, it was about just a few months before my 11th birthday.
All right.
And her response was to give me a package of pads and say, "Read the directions."
Okay.
So, I'm sorry to talk about it. I don't mean to make you uncomfortable.
No, you're fine. I'm fine. You're fine.
But this is my, you know, how my mother treated it. And so I think I was more free than a lot of people to develop my own. I didn't have the guilt inflicted on me as much because she just didn't talk about it at all.
All right.
And so by the time I got to, and in grammar school, we had no sex education, we had no nothing. So by the time I got to high school, and I did go to a Catholic high school, was taught by the nuns. But by that time, as I said, I was precocious. I had already formed my, my sexuality had formed, my opinions had formed. And so even though in high school the nuns did, start laying it on kind of thick, I had already formed by then. It was too late.
Okay.
It was too late to inflict that guilt.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's funny how you took the lack of communication and rather than, I suppose, kind of attaching some shame and automatically suspecting it was an area not to go in your life, it just left you, I suppose, kind of neutral, which is probably
kind
the best
neutral.
Place to be, you know?
Yes, and I've always been, very a very pragmatic kind of person, and so it just seemed to me, when I discovered it at about 14 that that my sex appeal would get me things,
yeah.
I went from there. And I mean, it didn't immediately translate into cash. I wasn't doing formal sex work at any time in my teens or 20s, not formally.
Okay.
But I was definitely manipulative. I mean, I definitely would the story I tell in my blog is the example of, a guy calls up for a date, and I say something like, "Oh, well, Joe, I'd love to go with you, but I'm just so stressed out about not being able to pay my electric bill."
Okay.
And then Joe says, "Oh, well, I'll pay your electric bill." And so it's not a direct exchange, but it's close enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did that in my teens. I did that in my 20s. And so it was not... actually, it's very funny. By the time I got to when I started doing formal sex work, which was just a few weeks shy of my 31st birthday, it's funny that I didn't think of it sooner.
Yeah, because you only got involved in stripping at the age of 30, right?
Yeah, almost 31.
Yeah, and in a way, like if you think of kind of the public perception, and excuse my ignorance, but it's my only exposure to it kind of through the media and stuff, we imagine even strippers, right, who would, I would imagine, would be at the less offensive end, the kind of people who are offended by sex work.
Of course.
I have the picture of the... kind of 18, 19-year-old, dumb blonde, trailer trash. That's what I picture.
Of course, you always say, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, that's
and you're 30, you have a degree. Had you a master's or a doctorate at the same time? Or?
Master's.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you decided to go into stripping. Why then?
Because the nutshell version is that my ex-husband left me with $90,000 worth of bills on a $24,000 a year salary.
Okay.
It was not going to submit to paying huge interest for the rest of my life. I wasn't going to do it.
Okay.
And so when I discovered, when the idea of stripping did, and actually what happened was I was looking through classified ads at a local strip club because my car had broken down. I had no car. I only had a bicycle to get around on. And a local strip club within easy bicycling distance of where I was living at the time, they actually took out a classified ad, which is pretty unusual for strip clubs,
yeah.
I think, but this one did, and it had they actually had taken the rather unusual step of promising a minimum income.
Okay.
And the minimum income was $1,200 a week, and I had never seen $1,200 a week in my life. Now,
yeah.
Of course, now I know that that's very low end, but at the time, it seemed like a princely sum to me.
Yeah.
And so I said, hell, I can do that. But one of the things that eventually exhausted me with stripping was that I was 31 years old trying to keep up with 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds.
Okay.
It was tough. It was tough keeping up with those girls, those younger girls, And so eventually it got to the point where I just got much more pragmatic, and I said, why am I wasting my time? When the part I like is the interaction anyway. I like dealing with the customers more than I like actually being up on the stage.
Okay, and when you say you
and
like
some
that...
girls are the opposite.
Yeah, when you say you like that, what did you get from that experience?
With what?
With dealing with the customers. What was pleasurable about that? Surely it's horribly repetitive with needy guys, no?
I hate to use the expression because it's so trite. But I really am kind of a people person.
Okay.
I like dealing with people, and yeah, it can be repetitive sometimes. And of course, there's drunks. Drunks are not really a lot of fun to deal with.
Sure.
But most of the time, I found it was no worse to me than dealing with customers in retail, and more money.
Okay.
A lot more money.
Yeah.
When I worked for a retail electronics store, I didn't my being nice to customers didn't get me much more money. It got me a little more. But when I was nice to guys in a strip club, it got me a lot more.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
and the same thing with once I started doing the escorting, it was got me a lot more.
Yeah.
Just
to get to the thing about escorting, I have about five or six rapid fire questions I want to throw at you before we finish up, right? The first one would be just that. What type of money did you make at the peak of your earnings?
I would average about a little over $3,000 a week.
Okay. And how much work did you have to do for that?
That was 16 calls a week.
Okay. Okay.
So it was 16 hours of actually being in the room. But of course there's also transit time, and then there's time running the company, and then there's time just the waiting. And I found really the part that frustrated me the most was just having to be on call all the time. Answer that phone, even if I was eating dinner, you know, even if I was whatever.
Yeah. What do you feel you've learned about men in your time kind of working in the sex industry?
The best thing I learned about men, the thing that, and escorting or working in the sex industry in general, I think some women, it makes them like men less. I think it kind of made me like men more.
Really?
Because, well, what I've always genuinely liked men. I don't have a problem with that. I like men. But I think one of the things that was kind of reassuring, that was kind of nice, was that as a sex worker, you tend to see that there's a certain commonality among men, that even if a man has a fancy title, even if he has a degree, even if he's a scientist or a doctor or a lawyer or a politician or a priest or whatever, that the same sorts of things interest him as other men. And I'm not saying that all men are the same. I'm saying
sure.
that there's that thread of commonality. You can, just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you won't enjoy, a woman with big breasts. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And that's nice. That's kind of nice. That it's that putting their pants on it one leg at a time sort of thing.
Okay. All right. And why did you finish being a call girl? I mean, I presume you're finished, right?
Yes.
What caused you to finish?
Well, I was married, and so, you know, eventually I did want to quit again. But what was happening was the immediate cause was that after Katrina, my health started to go down because all the water in the city had caused a lot of, like, mold and things like that, and
okay.
I had sinus problems. And so as the months went on, breathing that stuff, it was affecting my health. And then plus, once the first 3 months or so went by after Katrina, so around Christmas, let's say, what started happening was that a lot of other girls started to come in to take advantage, you know, of the large number of men there.
Yeah, so the word would have gotten out, there's a lot of money to be made in New Orleans, yeah?
Exactly. And
okay.
So the number, the pie was being sliced up, you know, into a smaller, greater and greater number of pieces, and the pie itself was getting smaller because... it's a long, long story, but basically the federal government was not paying the companies as quickly as it should have been. And so a lot of the companies, the upper management types, the engineers and the presidents of the companies and all that, that normally would be in my clientele that could afford to hire me, those guys were leaving.
Okay.
And so the pie was getting smaller, and it was being sliced up bigger and bigger. And so my income was dropping, and so by May, I wasn't even doing one a day.
Okay.
And with my health failing, that was not enough to justify my staying there.
All right.
And eventually my husband got to the point, he noticed I was getting snappish with clients on the phone, and I had never been that way before.
Okay.
And he said, no, it's time for you to go home.
How come your husband was so open-minded? I mean, most guys listen to this. I was actually trying to avoid asking the question when you mentioned your husband, but I kind of have to. How did he make his peace with that? How did that work for him?
Well, it started because part of it was that he was a client.
Okay.
He started out as my favorite client, and we got married after that. And so that was part of it. But I think part of how he made his peace with it, it was just watching me. In other words, that he could see from the way I behaved that it really was a job.
Models.
That it wasn't that I was romantically involved with these guys, that I wasn't going to run off on him, that I wasn't, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it was just a job to me, you know? And he, after a while, when he heard me come out of a call and I sounded, talking about the call, just like another woman might sound after a day at the office.
Okay.
Oh, that was such an easy client, you know, who's such a nice guy. Or, oh my God, I'm glad that's done. Oh, you know,
yeah,
that guy was aggravating. Or nothing at all.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just an eh.
Yeah, so he obviously had a similar attitude to sex, just being sex, the way driving cars is just driving cars and swimming is swimming or whatever. It's just an act.
Yeah.
It's a physical act, you know?
Yeah, I think he had more that sort of an attitude, putting less meaning to it.
Okay.
Putting less meaning to it.
Okay. Okay. There's one other question I want to cover because it's kind of relevant over here. In Ireland, there's a website recently set up for kind of sugar daddies where they kind of get girls generally who are in university to sign up in exchange for gifts, right? There were 500 girls actually in a relatively small Irish university who signed up for that, much to my amazement. What would the attitude towards those type of sites be in the general community of traditional call girls?
Well, we don't have a problem with them, certainly. The only issue we have, and I'm speaking for others as well, because I've seen, not because I find like I'm a representative of them, but I've just heard this a lot. What it is, it's not that they're doing it that bothers us. It's the what we call whorearchy. It's this thing you see over and over and over in the sex industry that some kinds of sex work are better than other kinds. And so you'll have strippers, for example, that will say, oh, well, I'm so much better than escorts because I don't have to go to bed with my clients. I
sure.
can get money for not. And there was an argument on Twitter very recently where there's apparently, it's part of the whole Bell Knox thing.
Yeah.
This young lady at Duke who's when we're doing porn, where a lot of these porn stars are making these noises like they're better than escorts.
Okay.
And, of course, this is ridiculous because we're all sex workers. So when a sugar baby, and I've seen some of them do it, will come out and say, oh, no, this is not prostitution because fill in the blank. They make up some stupid reason.
Okay.
Of course it's prostitution. Of course it is. It's just a different form. It's a different kind. And as long as they recognize that, I have nothing against anybody doing what makes them comfortable. Some girls are comfortable doing phone sex. Some girls are comfortable doing porn. Some girls prefer to strip. You know, some girls prefer to escort. There's different forms of escorting, you know.
Mm.
And so these are all different, and there's nothing wrong with that. What's the wrongness to me is when women will subscribe to that notion. It's the Madonna whore thing all over again.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different groups. It's drawing these lines. It's I'm better than you because
sure.
fill in the blank. And this is one of the reasons that I think we still are fighting for our rights in the early years of the 21st century.
It's crazy.
Because if you look at the gay rights movement, what did the gay rights movement do? Gays and lesbians, and they brought in bisexual people. They initially embraced transgender people, and they made what they called the GLBT movement. In other words, they took all these groups that really were different and brought them together under one umbrella, and they said, we're all fighting together for our rights.
Yeah.
And sex workers have not done that. Sex workers, it's still the strippers against the porn stars, against the escorts, against the street workers, against the phone, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, okay.
And until we stop doing that, it's going to be very, very, well, there's the old expression, divide and conquer.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's exactly what the prohibitionists do. The prohibitionists divide and conquer.
Yeah.
They as long as we keep fighting amongst each other, we will not be able to defeat them.
Yeah, okay, brilliant. That's a great answer. Listen, our time is almost up. I'd really like to thank you for coming on the show. You've been an absolutely wonderful guest.
You're very welcome.
I'd also like to thank you for your patience, kind of when I had some technical difficulties. Hopefully our listeners won't pick up on those,
right.
But you've been really patient. I've been following your blog, which is The Honest Courtesan at WordPress. I'll put the links up at the start and end of the show, my intro and outro. You have a wonderful Twitter, at Maggie McNeil, which I love. And thanks a million just for kind of shedding some light, you know, on kind of an area where a lot of people have a lot of issues, I think. I think you've taken some of the judgmental mystique from it and just kind of brought a normalcy, if you like, kind of to your discussion about sex, and you've certainly given me a lot to think about. So the best of luck with your blog, the best of luck with
Thank
your fiction.
You.
And if anybody wants to go onto your WordPress site, they'll also discover some nice recipes for cookies.
Yes.
Isn't that quaint? So, listen, thanks a million, Maggie, and I'll talk to you soon.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, that was Maggie. Hope you enjoyed listening to her as much as I enjoyed talking to her. I'd like to welcome anybody who's new to the show and thank anyone who downloaded the last show. Please subscribe on iTunes, follow on Twitter at InspirePod. Check out our blog, theinspirelandpodcast.com, and make sure to tell your friends. Our next episode is out in 2 weeks. I hope to launch one every 2 weeks from now on. The guest is fantastic, another guest from stateside. I won't tell you who it is yet till it's in the can, but let's just say it's somebody you'll be interested in. Goodbye, thanks for listening, and stay inspired.